May it please the court. This case should be remanded to the probate court so that there can be instructions for the probate judge to appoint Ruth Michaels as personal representative of the estate of her late husband so that the estate can pursue the cause of action announced by this court in the underlying case of Michaels v. Danrad. If she is not given that opportunity through equity, then this court will witness Ruth having spent countless years to attain a new cause of action, only to see herself deprived of that because she did not predict 9 years ago that it would be necessary for her to have an estate open, which would then become the vehicle through which this claim could be pursued. I would submit to the court that that would be a miscarriage of justice and that equity requires that she be so appointed.
Wasn't this cause of action always available?
I think not, Your Honor. In fact, I think if the court looks at the case of Morton v. Muchnick, we would see the identical set of circumstances, different disease, but the identical fact pattern. And it was in Morton where the Western District declared that it appears that plaintiffs are arguing that they should be allowed to recover damages for Mr. Morton's lost chance to have his life extended by an unknown period of time until his ultimate death as a result of AIDS-related illness. Unfortunately, Missouri does not recognize such a cause of action.
That was a Court of Appeals decision. What effect does that have on our court?
Well, I think the real impact is on litigants. What about that Morton case would tell someone like Ruth Michaels or even her attorneys that she needs to open an estate within 1 year so that she can try to pursue a claim that has not been announced in this court, that was flatly rejected, admittedly not by this court, but there's no ambiguity in what that case said.
But have we ever, in a civil action, not dealing with constitutional rights, said that when we recognize a new civil cause of action, all prior plaintiffs get to reopen their cases and bring those now?
I don't think Your Honor has. This court has not. And in fact, there's a whole dearth of what happens after new causes of action are actually.
Well, generally, we say they're over. I mean, I understand exactly the equitable point you're making. Maybe you could make an argument this is still pending, but other cases are not. But certainly, you're not saying you could go back 100 years, you could go back 50 years, reopen, final things are res judicata at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. My point, and I've tried to think about how the court would consider what I'm asking for. And I think that this court can narrowly tailor the facts, narrowly tailor its opinion to the very discrete facts in this case, which is Ruth is the litigant. She is not a third party who is coming in to try to now seek the benefit of something else. This is the effort that she has put forth, the case law that is developed over these 7 years all has led to this point. If she cannot pursue this cause of action, then it would simply be the height of inequity.
And talking about that would be changing the capacity in which she sues. But do we also have to, and if she were a personal representative already, then that's the only issue we'd have, but she's not yet.
She's not, and that really raises one of the issues that I feel is extremely relevant here. This court, when it decided Michaels v. Danrad, it focused on the Tappan case out of Florida and another Florida companion case. And in that those cases, when the Florida court was able to adopt a similar procedure for allowing these causes of action to move forward, they did not have the dichotomy that we suffer. We have wrongful deaths which are pursued by individuals, family members of the decedent. We have lost chance and survival claims that are pursued through the estate. In Florida, everything goes through the estate. So there was not this issue that when they learned the Tappan decision, while it may have been surprising to the litigants, no one was deprived of the opportunity to pursue the case because the estate had already been opened for the wrongful death case.
If she was the PR and she had sought to substitute parties and amend the petition, we'd have a lovely debate about relation back and whether that applies, and it would all be de novo in this court, as I understand it. But she's not the PR, and the question is, did the probate court have some obligation that it failed by making her the PR or by refusing to make her the PR? And is that to be reviewed under a more deferential standard than we might if we were here purely on relation back?
I think we are here on de novo because the the relation back issue is something that'll probably, if I have my way, will be decided by Judge Bringer Shepherd, because I know that Mr. Morthland has already teed up the statute of limitations. I think that's something that Judge Bringer Shepherd should have the opportunity to determine. I have reasons why I think she should determine it favorably for us. But to your point, I don't think you reach any of the Karen-type deference that you would see if there was evidence put on the record, if there was a bench trial. Here, it was simply a matter of the probate judge seeing our application, noting on its face that Joe died more than a year before we saw application, and saying, well, you're out of time, and statute.
And why was that incorrect?
Yeah. How is that error?
Well, I think that's error because, frankly, I think the probate court has equitable powers, and I think they should have used those powers to consider whether or not Ruth should be appointed under these very unique set of circumstances.
But if that's true, if they have discretion to ignore the statutory deadline, then surely they have. Then we would give a deferential review to the exercise or the failure to exercise that discretion. It can't be both ways.
I suppose if there was some indication that the court had done that, that then we might be having a different conversation. But it seemed from the face of the two-sentence order that was not something that...
You're saying here the court thought it didn't have discretion, so we should remand to let it exercise that discretion?
Absolutely. That's exactly what I would ask this court to
but
do.
But again, I believe it was in dissent in the case that said we... But the majority held that we don't have discretion to extend the statute of limitations for equitable reasons when it's set out clearly in the statute. We're stuck with that. Why wouldn't that apply here to the personal representative situation? How can we say equity changes the meaning of the statute, even if we'd like it to? What is our authority?
Sure. Well, I don't think it would make sense for... Well, I'm sorry, I'm not sure which case you're referring
to. That's all right.
Okay. So, in this instance, there was no reason for Ruth to have filed, to have opened a probate action prior to this court's announcement in Michaels v. Danrin. I think to require her to have concluded that she needed to open in the state beforehand.
So what does that make the rule being, if someone doesn't know they need to be a personal representative, they can always reopen? Because that's what we have to think of. What are you asking us to adopt as our rule?
Well, I think the rule of equity would be that which ought to have been done shall be deemed done by equity. I mean, that's one of the maxims. And I bristle at the notion that she didn't know she should have done something, because quite frankly, I think it was within days of the Michaels opinion coming down, we were in fact doing exactly what Michaels said. This is not a mistake of a well-established principle of law. I know some of the cases that were cited by intervener talk about, if somebody makes a mistake, vest in realty, I believe. If it's a mistake as to something well known about the law, we're not going to excuse that. Well, I'm not asking for an excuse. Ruth doesn't want any favors from this court. What we want is the opportunity to litigate the new cause of action, which until her efforts brought that cause of action out of this court, did not exist. So it's a set of circumstances so unique, I don't think we have to worry about floodgates being opened. I don't think we have to worry about there being people constantly entitled to say that equity trumps the statute of limitations.
But where do you draw the line? I mean, your opponent says you're just creating a slippery slope and having us employ equity, but how do you draw the line?
Well, I think if this court wanted to say that we're going to limit it to circumstances where there is a new cause of action arising from the work of the purported personal rep, I mean, you could certainly make a narrowly tailored decision. And I think judges, both at the trial level, at the probate.
What about situations where there's a removal of a cause of action? And will defendants be able to come in and ask for equity, saying, gosh, I wish you would remove that cause of action a year ago?
Well, I think that actually gets back to the point that your colleague made, which is, are we going to do this for cases that ended 100 years ago? The nice part for the defendant in that case, where they're up on appeal and you remove a cause of action, is the cause of action's done. The defendant did get their way. Here, I feel in a sense that out of the Michaels v. Danrad decision, it was a benefit to Ruth, the decision, and now she doesn't get to take advantage of it.
You're just saying limited to the one who brought the action that created the cause of action. So
that would be
one particular person.
That would be one way to avoid that sort of slippery slope.
Section 472.030.
That's
the probate statute that says the court shall have the same legal and equitable powers
right. To
effectuate its jurisdiction and to enforce its orders, judgments, and decrees in probate matters as it has in other matters.
Correct.
It appears to be a limitation on the equitable powers of the court or a recognition of them, but it limits them to equitable powers to effectuate its jurisdiction and to enforce its orders, judgments, and decrees. What you're asking this court to use equitable powers for doesn't seem to fit within the language of that statute.
Well, I suppose it depends on exactly how the relief was crafted, but if the court said, well, we're going to order that she be appointed personal rep, then I would say that they did use their equitable powers to effectuate its order. And certainly here, that's exactly what we're asking, is that the court be allowed to do that. I think they have that power. There's not a lot of case law on that statute, as Your Honor is no doubt aware, but in some of the cases that have interpreted it, Myers Estate, I believe, it does talk about it is broad. And I think
you're saying that statute allows you to use jurisdiction to enforce an order that isn't contemplated by the probate scheme.
I think that is largely the nature of equity, is that it has to fill in where there are situations that are not contemplated.
But it says you can do it as if you were a regular, you know, a non-probate judge. So what's the authority of the non-probate judge to do this?
Well, you're saying that if it was a circuit court judge faced
yes.
with a similar circumstance, I think those judges could also consider circumstances that are beyond the normal scope of a statute and decide whether or not in that instance, whatever it may be, could they have that same opportunity. I mean, I guess it would depend on the circumstances, but if we were in a court, for example, that did not have a separate probate judge, and the circuit court was going to handle all such matters before it, I would be asking for the same relief from the circuit judge.
So is there authority to where a court has used equity to avoid a statute of limitations?
Certainly not under circumstances where there's been a newly created cause of action.
Under any circumstances?
I think they would be very limited, and I think this court has written in Boland about the limited set of circumstances where those can be handled.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. We are dealing here with RSMO 473.020, which is the statute, very simple statute, dealing with when someone has to apply to be personal representative of the state. The last rendition of this statute was done in 1996 by the legislature, and I think it is significant that there are no exceptions posited by the legislature in that statute as to the one-year limitation. I think it's also important to note that pursuant to the Supreme Court's ruling in Johnson versus Akers, this is what is called a special statute of limitations, which is a statute of limitations that is created by a statute that's not governed by the general statutes of limitation in Chapter 516. The court's decision in Johnson v. Akers was adopted by the Eastern District of our U.S. District Court in Rapa versus Novartis in 2014, for the same reason. Since it is a special statute of limitations, and since it's not governed by Chapter 516, this court has ruled since 1897 that a court of equity cannot alter the terms of a special statute of limitation. Starting with Stowe in 1897, Stowe versus Stowe, and ending with Bolin versus St. Luke's Hospital 28 months ago, this court has held that a court of equity will not create a de facto exception to a statute of limitation, and that's exactly what the appellants are requesting.
Does that give any meaning to the statute that Judge Breckenridge was speaking about with Mr. Neal? That a probate court has the equitable powers of a circuit court?
A court of equity does have equitable powers similar to a circuit court, but the case law of this court is that those equitable powers can't change or create a de facto exception to what the legislature has created in terms of statute of limitations.
And Mr. Neal's saying we should create an exception to that rule where it's a newly created cause of action. Can you address whether equity lets us do that?
I don't believe so. I look at this case and this situation compared to the Bolin case. The Bolin case is one of the most egregious set of facts that I can ever imagine. You have a respiratory therapist intentionally killing patients, which is bad enough. Then you have the hospital covering it up so that the families don't know until the federal government gets involved. And in that case, this court held that even though that's an egregious situation, the fact of the matter is the statute does not provide, the wrongful death statute does not provide an exception.
Of course, we did hold the other way in the companion case. But.
It might very well, yeah. Your Honor. But I still think you go to the Stowe case, you go to the case of Beer versus Judge Bigger, which is a case sort of near and dear to my heart. It's a Marion County case. For what it's worth, our law office is next to where Judge Bigger used to live. But in that case, and this is a situation that could still happen today, the time for probating or filing a will at that time was 1 year.
Are there cases that have recognized an exception to the normal rules for the person who brings a claim that they get the benefit of a change in the law in that case, even if others don't?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that your point made in regard to Mr. Neal's point is that okay, we've created, you allege that we've created, I don't think it was a new cause of action in Michael's one, but you allege that we've created a new cause of action. Does that mean that the statute begins then for people 10, 20 years ago that did not bring a cause of action?
He's just saying for the person, I mean, that's one argument he made, but the fallback argument was that for the person who got that new cause of action created, there must be some incentive for people to bring actions and try to change the law, and if you're going to foreclose them from taking advantage of it, that's not doing equity.
Once again, I don't think that applies when you're dealing with a statutory scheme. There's a very real distinction, and this court has drawn it, between the general statute on limitations and specific statutes on limitation. And another thing I want to add in this case to remember in this Michaels case, my radiologist read this MRI, and I think it was in December of 08. Mr. Michaels died in June of 09. His treating oncologist, who testified via deposition, is the individual who started this whole case rolling, who testified that even if my client misread the film in December of 2008, he was dead anyway. He had a fatal disease. They knew or should or could have known at that time when this man died from his own treating doctor that, you know, he was going to die anyway. Well, if there's any question in your mind that you don't have a wrongful death case, then you file something else. You file a survivorship action, which Judge Wilson says this is. You file a claim for lost chance of survival. And in either of those cases, a personal representative is required. The only time a personal representative is not required in a medical malpractice case such as this is a wrongful death case. So it's not like this thing came out of the blue and this unusual fact situation came out of the blue. It was in existence when this gentleman was still alive. And I think that's significant. We have alternative pleading. Quite frankly, in many medical malpractice cases I've been involved in, you plead in the alternative for everything because you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what the law might be by the time your case gets to court. But I also think the Caldwell versus Lester E. Cox case is significant here. Now, that's a Southern District case. It's not this court's case, but this court declined a motion for transfer. But in Cox, the gentleman died, young boy died, I believe, on January 3rd of 90. His parents filed a wrongful death action down in the Southern District on February 4th of 92, petition for wrongful death. The significant thing is that this court issued Woolen on April 2, 1992, almost 2 months later, and created the cause of action for lost chance of survival, truly a new cause of action. The plaintiffs then filed a second amended petition on February 11, 1993, and this was the first time they pled this new cause of action of lost chance of survival. The Southern District provided that the individual died on January 90, January 3rd of 1990. If you wanted to file a lost chance of survival claim, which has a 2-year statute, it had to be filed by January 3rd, 1992. They ignored the significance of whether or not this was a new cause of action or not. And so in that case, a truly new cause of action is created, and it was created after the statute had already run in regard to these people. So I think that case lends credence to the argument that just because this might be arguably a new cause of action, that you're given any time of additional time on it.
And even if you could have that debate about whether you could extend the statute of limitations on the cause of action, that has nothing to do with whether or not you can allow a probate judge to grant papers to a PR after the statute has closed that door. That's not a cause of action.
It's even though they refer to it as a statute of limitation, it's not a statute of limitation in regard to a cause of action. It's a statute of limitation, I assume, in regard to standing. And, you know, the legislature is presumed to know, I think, certainly in this day and age, what this court's rulings have been. The legislature's presumed to know of the Beer versus Bigger case that if some undertaker's hiding the will until after the 1 year's run, that if that's not fair, they can make an exception to that in the statute. They can make an exception to it in the statute if a new cause of action truly is created. But this court has consistently held that when there's a statute, a special statute, that this no doubt is, that has a time limit, equity leaves it alone. Whether it's equity exercised in the probate division of our circuit court or equity executed and used in the circuit court. And although, you know, the cases are legion about whether or not this is a harsh result, I think maybe it was in Bolin. There was language from an old English case that hard times make good law or something to that effect. It might be unfortunate, but it's the law. And what the plaintiffs would be arguing in this case is to have a personal representative appointed 7 years after this gentleman died. Not missing it by 2 days, not missing it by 2 weeks, 7 years after this gentleman died to pursue this cause of action. I also want to address the issue of the statute of limitations. If this, well, the court ruled that they did have a survivorship cause of action, that's a 2-year statute of limitations. They missed that by a year and a half. And I think, you know, equity will not require the court to do or some futile act.
And opposing counsel says that's not been litigated yet below.
Not been litigated, and I don't know, quite frankly, Your Honor, if this court has the jurisdiction or authority to hear it, but it seems to make sense to me. This is our second time up here on this case. It seems to make sense to me for us to at least brought it up. So you not only have missing the limitations period, the special statute of limitations to appoint a PR within a year, you have missing the 2-year statute of limitations on a survivorship claim by a year and a half. And our position is simply that this would open the floodgates. What would be the difference if somebody misses the 6-month non-claim for filing a substantial claim against the estate because they're told that, you know, there was no claim, or that the claim was paid, or that they're lied to? Is that going to be, are we going to come up here and have an exception to that? Are we going to have an exception to the time within which to file a will contest if the will's being hidden and absconded from someone? You know, that's 6 months from the date of the first publication of notice of letters. I mean, the probate code sets up time limits, and I think the case law of the court requires you to abide by those time limits. And that's all we're asking for in this case. Thank you very much.
Counsel, let me push back a little bit. What is the new cause of action? No, sir, you're fine. What is the new cause of action you think was created in this?
It's going to be the opportunity, the lost opportunity to have delayed death. I believe that's how it was phrased in this case, Michaels. It was said the opposite way in Morton, where it was lost opportunity to have extended life. But I think it's the same issue.
Well, I mean, it's clearly not, as we went out of our way to distinguish Wolin and that lost chance.
No, I'm sorry, not Morton, the Morton right. v. Munchnick case.
Well, which was a Wolin-esque case.
Well, the court in Wolin was quite clear that the way they interpreted the plaintiff's cause of action was that they were asking for a cause of action for the opportunity to extend life. Which they said Missouri does not recognize. That was the case also where Judge Kennedy suggested that it be treated as a wrongful death case with truncated damages, in the sense that the person's life expectancy was going to be prematurely reached, even in the absence of negligence. I would like to address one thing quickly, though, Your Honor, which is the issue of the state legislature. And I know that Missouri courts are loath to jump in and try to rewrite the rules for the legislature, and for good reason. But I think it's important to remember that this cause of action was for the lost opportunity to delay death, was not produced by the legislature. And at the time Michaels came down, the legislature would have been presumed to have been aware of Morton. And so the fact that I am asking you to extend for Ruth Michaels the opportunity to open an estate is in no way a situation that would have been contemplated by the legislature, because they didn't contemplate the opportunity to pursue this type of action in the first place. I'd also like to address these other exceptions that John has mentioned, and will we now start having people trying to pursue probate matters that are beyond time limits for mistakes of fact, not for a failure to predict what the law is going to be years down the road.
Well, hasn't historically, though, the difference being that he used the word specific, but I think it's special statute of limitations. The doctrine of equitable tolling, which is basically what you're suggesting, applies to general statutes of limitation, but does not apply to special statutes of limitation.
Yeah. Well, I'm not entirely convinced that this is a statute of limitations in the first place. It's a statute, and it prescribes a time limit to do something. So I guess in that sense it is. It's certainly not what I would normally consider to be a statute of limitations in the sense of when you bring an action. I mean, we're asking for an estate to be opened so that other other opportunities can be pursued. One last thought. I see I'm out of time. If I can just remind the court that the notion that within 1 year we would have been filing if we thought there was a lost chance claim, that still doesn't get us where we would need to be, because oftentimes those claims will be opened pursuant to 537.021 more than 1 year after but less than 2 years after. So you would still have this problem because it's not really a dichotomy of actions. In a sense, there is three different dates that have to be floating around in the context of death cases now. I don't think it's fair for Ruth to be precluded from pursuing one of those three. Thank you.
Thank you.